The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
The story of the UK is an economy that has got real momentum.
What is broken can be repaired. What is ruined can be rebuilt.
UK inflation is becoming much more homegrown.
We have huge potential as an economy in the UK.
This is a time to tell Israel there is a path to peace.
Our plan for the British economy is working, but the work is not done.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm James Alcock.
Now, in a moment, we are going to get into our usual guessing game of which attack lines Keir Starmer is going to take during Prime Minister's questions. He's certainly got quite a few to choose from this week. But before we get into that, the news that we've had from RTE out of Ireland, our near neighbours, Leo Varadkar, is stepping down as the Irish Prime Minister. He was the youngest leader of the country, faces an election pretty soon. But this comes, of course, only days after a crushing defeat of two referendums that were put to the public in the Republic of Ireland on amending the constitution. It was a real shock to the establishment. Is that the reason? We don't really know yet.
And I mean, with Varadkar, he's a name that a lot of British listeners will find familiar because obviously he led a lot of the Brexit negotiations and was a key voice in that. Those who might remember the sort of visit to Boris Johnson where they all walked in sort of north of England, where we then came up with sort of the border in the Irish Sea. I think, Caroline, it's been interesting this year. We've talked about this massive year it is for democracy. And what comes with that is a lot of leaders stepping down. We had, you know, the First Minister of Wales, Mark Drakeford, stepping down just recently as well. I wonder if we're going to see a lot more leaders trying to kind of choreograph their exit as we head into elections. Because obviously, while we have in the US election, Biden and Trump, two incumbents, former incumbents in Trump's case, going up against each other, in many other cases, it's people who are trying to kind of exit to the very difficult move in politics of getting out without a scandal.
Yes, okay. The issue in terms of the details around Varadkar, though, remember he's been in the US on St. Patrick's Day and rebuking the US for its support of Israel. Obviously, that's a long-standing Irish position. But also on the referendums in particular, they were trying to change... Okay, Keir Starmer standing up in Parliament. Let's listen in.
Welcoming Vaughan Gething to his post as First Minister of Wales. As the first black leader of any European government, it's a historic moment that speaks to the progress and values of modern-day Wales. Yeah. And I also pay tribute to Mark Drakeford for his long, steady service in Wales. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, violent prisoners released early because the Tories wrecked the criminal justice system. 3,500 small boat arrivals already this year because the Tories lost control of the borders. Yeah. The NHS struggling to see people because the Tories broke it. Millions paying more on their mortgages. A budget that hit pensioners. A £46 billion hole in his sums. Why is the Prime Minister so scared to call an election?
Well, Mr. Speaker, as I said in January, my working assumption is that the election will be in the second half of the year. But I must say, I thought that out of everybody, he'd actually be the most grateful, Mr. Speaker, because he's now actually got time to come up with a plan for Britain. We're all looking forward to finally seeing it.
We're ready. Just call it. Mr. Speaker, he talks a plan. Let's just take his Rwanda policy. When they first announced this gimmick, they claimed it would settle tens of thousands of people. The Home Office then whittled it down to a mere 300. Four times that number have already arrived this month, and the backlog stands at 130,000. Can the Prime Minister see any flaw in his plan to deport less than 1% of that backlog?
Mr Speaker, since I became Prime Minister, the number of small boat crossings are actually down by over a third, Mr Speaker. And that's because we've doubled National Crime Agency funding, we've increased the illegal enforcement raids by 70%, we've closed 7,500 bank accounts, deported 24,000 illegal migrants, and processed over 112,000 cases, more than at any point in the last two decades, Mr Speaker. And it's crystal clear, as we're seeing from the Labour Party's opposition in this House, while we're committed to stopping the boats, the Labour Party would keep them coming.
The tragedy is, we know the Prime Minister doesn't even believe in the Rwanda gimmick. He tried to stop funding it, but he's now so diminished that his entire focus is stopping his MPs holding the sword of Damocles above his head, perhaps even literally in the case of the Leader of the House. His great hope is to placate his party with a couple of empty planes, praying they won't notice when the flights stop going, the boats still coming, and the costs keep mounting. How has he managed to spend £600 million of taxpayer money on a gimmick to deport 300 people?
Mr Speaker, it's crystal clear, not only does the Labour Party not have a plan to fix this issue, but the truth is they don't actually care about fixing this issue. When he talks about the gangs, when we gave the police new powers to crack down on the people smuggling gangs, he spent months campaigning and voting against it. Thanks to our new laws, 900 criminals have been arrested. 450 have been convicted, serving over 370 years behind bars. If it was up to him, those criminals would still be out on our streets, Mr Speaker. And the truth is, if he wasn't the Labour leader, he'd still want to be their lawyer.
Stop. Speaker, I've prosecuted more people smugglers than he's had helicopter rides, and that's a lot. And this, I've done it. Rwanda gimmick is going to cost the taxpayer £2 million for every one of his 300 people that they deport. And I know the Prime Minister likes to spend a lot on jet setting, but that's some plane ticket. It's the cost of Tory chaos, and it's working people who are paying the price. The man he made his immigration minister let the cat out of the bag when he said the Prime Minister's symbolic flights will not provide a credible deterrent. And we know the Prime Minister himself thought it wouldn't work. If the people selling this gimmick don't believe in it, why should the country?
Mr Speaker, he's very keen to talk about who he prosecuted. He's a bit less keen to talk about when he defended Hizbut Tahrir, Mr Speaker. When it comes to this question of how to deal with people who are here illegally, his values are simply not those of the British people. After all, this is the person who campaigned to stop the deportation of foreign dangerous criminals, Mr Speaker. A dangerous criminal was jailed for dealing Class A drugs after he fought to keep him here. A gangmaster was convicted of carrying a knife after he fought to keep him here. So whether it's representing terrorists or campaigning for criminals, it's clear whose side he's on, and it's not the British people.
It's genuinely sad to see him reduced to this nonsense. And let's take another example that I started with. After 14 years of Tory chaos in the prison system, the Justice Secretary is reduced to begging the Prime Minister either to send fewer offenders to prison or to release them even earlier. I must say I've got sympathy for anyone trying to get an answer out of the Prime Minister. So what's it going to be? Fewer criminals behind bars in the first place, or more released early onto our streets? Which is it?
Mr. Speaker, thanks to our record and plan, violent crime has fallen by 50%, Mr. Speaker. We've recruited more police officers, given them more powers, and kept serious offenders in prison for longer. What's his record? He voted against greater protection for our emergency workers, opposed tougher sentences for violent criminals, and failed to give police the powers they need. It would be back to square one with Labour, soft on crime and soft on criminals.
You can see why he doesn't want an election. Yeah. Why his party have lost faith in. Why half his cabinet are lining up to replace him. No answers, no plan, no clue. And the Prime Minister has never had the courage to stand up to his party. So let me help him out and say to them what he wishes he could. The mortgage mayhem, the waiting list, the criminals walking free, they are the cost of Tory chaos. And if they can't bring themselves to stop the endless games and gimmicks, stop putting themselves before country, they should pack up, go home, and waste somebody else's time. It wasn't that difficult, was it, Prime Minister?
Mr. Speaker,
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, he talks about his ideas, but we're 2 weeks on from the budget. The Shadow Chancellor found time to make a one-hour speech last night, and we still don't know how they're going to pay for their £28 billion black hole. But while he tries to talk down Britain and the progress that we are making, today's news shows that the plan is working. Inflation down, Mr. Speaker. Energy bills down. Wages up, pensions up, and taxes cut by £900. And that is the choice. Higher taxes and back to square one with Labour, or tax cuts and real change with the Conservatives.
That was Rishi Sunak there, closing off PMQs. Now, I mean, we talk about this a lot, Caroline, but the final answer is the thing that the Prime Minister gets to stress. And it is interesting that he chose to go for inflation and the economy as his key big victories, given, I think, Labour started this whole conversation at PMQs to start with talking about value for money and crime. And I think Keir Starmer clearly thinks that Rwanda and the crime system in general is his chance to pounce on how this is a wasteful scheme in terms of the money being spent on it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, it comes on the day, of course, when we had inflation figures out just this morning, and they did show a kind of cooling off in terms of inflation. And yet, you know, the overall numbers, we're not in double digits anymore, but, you know, if you look at underlying inflation, like food price inflation, it's still at 6%. I mean, that's getting better and improving on the headline rate for inflation, but it's and the Bank of England may give them more wind in the sails in order to cut interest rates in the UK, but it's still not something really to crow about in terms of what people will feel in their ordinary lives. So yes, the economy, I think, is very interesting. I think it is fascinating that Keir Starmer was talking about crime and about prisons. I think this will come up also in the May elections and the local elections and the mayoral elections here in London, for example, in particular, where it's an issue. The early release scheme that the opposition leader was also talking about, this is allowing prisoners to be released 18 days before their sentence is up. This was something that was already brought in and has now been expanded. I mean, you know, crime, that's a big issue. I think the Prime Minister didn't quite get across the line, the idea that Keir Starmer, you know, was and his prosecutorial record is something to be ashamed of.
I mean, the thing I noticed was the noise. I always remember the day that Boris Johnson then went from PMQs to the liaison committee, just the authority started disintegrating around him. It was a very noisy PMQs as his backbenchers roared to try and show that they were uniting behind their PM, even if behind the scenes there was a lot of other things going on. And Keir Starmer talked about it with that Sword of Damocles joke, was a reference to Penny Mordaunt holding the sword at the coronation for anyone who missed it.
Well, because he talked about half of Rishi Sunak's cabinet, you know, trying to get rid of him, basically, including Mordaunt, perhaps.
Exactly. And but Rishi Sunak's final point about it being 2 weeks on from the budget and where's Labour's economic plan, you can turn that around and say, it's 2 weeks on from the budget and where is your poll bounce? And I think that's what a lot of the cabinet fears seem to be around as well.
Yes, indeed. So Starmer also talking about, you know, come on the election, just call it. That was his view. So look, Prime Minister's questions are pretty interesting today. But of course, it comes after yesterday, Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves, who took to the stand to deliver the Mays lecture, pledging a fundamental course correction for the UK economy. She shared some big plans and a big vision, but there's been quite a mixed reaction so far.
Well, yes, I mean, with Labour 20 points ahead of the Conservative Party, a lot of people were looking for sort of the big vision, and Reeves is on track to be Britain's first female chancellor. So we've been discussing this big moment with Panmure Gordon's chief economist, Simon French, and started by asking him where he thinks she sits on the economic spectrum.
Quite interventionist, quite comfortable with the with not having the invisible hand taking control of the economy, but very much that hand being actively controlled, steered, encouraged by government strategy. So we are talking about perhaps in going back 30, 40 years, more of a Heseltinian view of how the UK economy should operate and strategically allocate its resources and regulate its industries, rather than a more pure Thatcherite view of the economy.
Yes, I think that's an interesting point, isn't it? I mean, she kept going back to and referring back to the 1960s and 1970s, talking about how the UK is in a moment of flux. How do you rate how Reeves actually analysed the problems that the UK has? I mean, she seemed on fairly solid ground, in which there does seem to be at least an economic consensus that, you know, the UK's got a really significant productivity problem, a problem with economic growth. I mean, what did you make of her economic analysis? Because that's what this speech was largely about. It was sort of, you know, it's meant to be a big platform for sort of economic thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I read the speech and I wrote in my note this morning to clients that this read like a university summative essay, which would have got a very good mark. She's clearly thought about this. She's brought together quite a rich array of empirical data points, innovative thinkers to produce that speech. But it did read like an evaluation report of the UK economy rather than a vision. And I guess I'm okay with that. But again, as I wrote, it's one thing to have a vision and eloquently describe some of the problems with the UK economy. But I think a lot of the challenges the current government have faced has been an inability to face down vested interests within their own party, within their own membership. And for the Conservatives, it is Europe, it is planning, it is immigration that has got in the way of what I think mainly in the last 13, 14 years, the leadership have thought is good economic strategy. And if it is to be a Labour government and it is to have its economic policy dictated by Rachel Reeves, the degree to which the same vested interests, albeit with different agendas, and you can think in terms of employer rights, the role of the state, higher taxation, taxation on wealth and capital, the more traditional centre-left agenda, more socialist agenda, whether that will perhaps get in the way of what at the moment is quite a clean slate narrative, but the nature of government is you quickly get faced by some very real political and economic issues, and you need to try and plot a path through the two.
You can detect a note of what you're talking to in sort of the three-word slogan that she sort of brought up: stability, growth, reform. I think that reform part of it is those faces of vested interest that you mention. I guess my question though is, there's a lot being staked on the stability element side of it as well. The idea being that stable Labour governance creates growth, which gives them the public sector funding to create reform.
Yes.
How fundamental is that reliance on stability? What happens if it doesn't come?
Well, it's a terrific question, and I'm pleased that this conversation we are now having, and this is credit to Bloomberg, some of the other media outlets this morning, have led with this review of Rachel Reeves' agenda by talking about the fiscal rules. The fiscal rules are the least interesting, the least relevant part of, I felt, what she spoke about last night. Why? Because the fiscal rules is element, there's an element of performative art, whether they're Gordon Brown's fiscal rules, George Osborne's fiscal rules, Philip Hammond's fiscal rules. I can't name, we haven't got time to name all the chancellors,
yeah.
But the versions, iterations of fiscal rules we've had, the performative art, no one seriously looks at them and goes, that is a financial empirical straitjacket. It's a signalling device of a broader sense of stability of a plan. And we saw in the mini budget under Kwasi Kwarteng and Liz Truss what happens if you ditch that and what the response is on gilt markets. Now, Securonomics, and this is why your question is so good, it effectively implies, although she didn't explicitly say it, that if we deliver a more stable economic governance than we've lived through in the last, certainly in the last 6 or 7 years, then actually the risk premium on UK government debt, largely gilts, comes down because international investors look at it as a more stable, less risky investment prospect for UK government debt. And that generates in and of itself, for the same set of fiscal rules, more headroom because debt servicing cost goes down. Now, she didn't lay that out as I perhaps clunkily have right now. This is why she gave the lecture I didn't. Many reasons why that happened. But the interesting element is, if Securonomics yields that dividend in terms of reduced interest payments, then she does have something to play with regarding dealing with the public sector spending challenges that we all know are looming the other side of the election.
But it's an if, isn't it? And surely, you know, growth is about perhaps more than just that. I mean, she talked about, you know, declinism in the UK and the need, you know, for a new way forward. And I suppose that's it, isn't it? It's this speech, as you say, was kind of an academic exercise, wasn't it? It was Rachel Reeves in her comfort zone, you know, talking about any economist that you care to name. But what about actually delivering on a real kind of momentum and boost? I mean, the UK needs to reverse that kind of declinist issue. And is Rachel Reeves the woman? Is the Labour Party the party to deliver that?
Well, it will be. That's a brave prediction. Always risky, isn't it, making predictions? But she will be the person who's tasked with trying to do it. I think it's a big moment for the UK statecraft, UK infrastructure, the civil service, the agents responsible for delivering government policy. Because part of what Securonomics says is actually we can use the public sector, delivery arms and its administration to just do things better. Just better, you know, at the heart of this is just better managerial competence. Now, I think there's a real challenge facing the civil service, the public sector, and part of getting growth back into the economy is boosting very, very poor public sector productivity. If that different approach, that clean slate, that different vision from Labour versus the Conservatives still doesn't get the arm of the state, which is 5.6 million public sector employees, lots of delivery arms that impact our everyday life, but whose productivity is lower today in 2024 than it was in 1997, a very damning statistic. It doesn't take much empirically to start generating growth from the public sector performing better, but if it doesn't, I think there's an existential question for the structure of how we deliver public services and broader policy making and policy delivery in the UK.
There's an odd paradox in a lot of what Labour are saying at the moment, because they paint this stark picture of what is being handed to them by the Conservatives. I mean, you just used the word existential. And yet their response to it seems almost muted. I mean, you look at someone like trade union boss Sharon Graham, she says Labour haven't done nearly enough to distinguish themselves from the Conservatives on the economy. Is there any truth to that? Is there a radicalism buried in what Reeves is saying?
No. But then we go back 27 years now to 1997, Gordon Brown took Ken Clark's spending plans laid out in the previous year comprehensive spending review and rolled those forward because it was a signalling device to markets that after a long period of one administration, there is a degree of continuity with economic plans. There are others, some of them with vested interests, some of them with more of a political hat than an economic hat, that goes, well, you will never be as powerful or have as much control as you will on day one when you enter Downing Street, so you need to act fast. And those two things are in tension, they're in competitive tension. But for what it is worth, I don't think that there is a big radical agenda, if you like, hiding away because it's worried it'll scare the electorate only to be unveiled the day after. I think there is a credibility to saying, actually, some of this improvement in economic performance is just stopping some of the self-harm that we've seen in recent years.
Well, continuity doesn't necessarily equate to the exact same approach. Well, thank you very much, Pamela Gordon's chief economist, Simon French, there for joining us. It's interesting, Caroline, that he was basically saying that just because Labour might currently be wearing Conservative Party's clothes doesn't mean they are necessarily the same people as we go into the next election.
Yes, I thought that was a very interesting point. The analysis then of Rachel Reeves is May's lecture yesterday. Very interesting from Simon French. That's it from us for today, though. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe. Give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by Tiwa Adebayo and Mia Dawkins. And our audio engineers were Maruthul Hussain and Sean Guastamacchia. I'm James Wilcock.
And I'm Caroline Hepke, and we'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.